Hello, Coach. Welcome to another episode. I hope you had a great and healthy Christmas close to your loved ones. My guest for this last episode of 2021 is Lisa Tomaitis from Canada. Coach Lisa coached the Canadian women's national team for 20 years, as we'll dive more into during this episode. Lisa has also coached the Huskies from the University of Saskatchewan since 1998, and where she has won two national championships and several Coach of the Year awards. So, Coach, please sit back, relax, and enjoy our conversation. Hello, everyone. Welcome to one more episode of Career Mode Podcast. I have with me Lisa Tomaitis. Welcome to the podcast. Thank you very much for your time. How is everything back in Canada?
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. Things in Canada are great. They're getting a little bit colder now that December is here, but can't complain. Our season is operating and our teams are playing. And so it's great to be back at it.
Great to know. And indeed, it's good to be back. So you just, this summer you just stepped down from the national team after incredible 20 years incredible performance. I'll start with that. How do you build that legacy, and how do you go from assistant coach for so many years then to go head coach and stay in the job doing a good job? So what's the secret?
Oh gosh. Yeah. When I first got involved, I was a young coach. You know, I got the opportunity to work with a tremendous mentor. I first worked with Bev Smith. She was the head coach at the time for 1 year. She's kind of like the Steve Nash of women's basketball in Canada. Did everything, medaled at the world championships, played at University of Oregon, played a number of years professionally in Italy and represented our national team for a number of years. So that was an amazing experience. And then the year after, Alison McNeil took over and I was one of her assistant coaches for 11 years. And to be honest, like that experience being an assistant under her, I mean, she's a legend in coaching in Canada, really passionate coach, great teacher of the game. So to be around her and to learn from her was an amazing professional development experience for me. And, you know, someone that I continue to stay in touch with. So when she took over, you know, we were fighting hard to get to world championships. And our ultimate goal and our ultimate achievement was in 2012 when we finally qualified for the London Olympics. And so that was from about 2001 to 2012. And the last time the Canadian team made the Olympics prior to 2012 was 2000. So it was 11 years of hard work. You know, at that point in time, our national team consisted of a lot of collegiate athletes. You know, we didn't have a ton of professional athletes at that time that were playing in Europe, playing in the best leagues in the world. So we were young, we were inexperienced. And I think, you know, one of the things that Allison's legacy was that she really instilled in the athletes the importance of continuing to play beyond university or college and going over to Europe and playing professionally. And that was really the only way that we were going to be able to, you know, climb the international ladder. So 2012 made it to the London Olympics. That was phenomenal. And I think that really led the way for what was going to happen next. And so she stepped down in 2013 or the end of 2012. And I was hired in 2013 to take over the team. And I was the head coach for 8 years. And it was, again, phenomenal experience. I think, you know, my time definitely reaped the rewards of a number of tremendous athletes, committed athletes who went over to Europe and played pro and made a life for themselves playing professional basketball and then came back and represented Canada. And so we qualified for the subsequent world championships. We finished fifth at the 2014 world championships, qualified for Rio, got through to a quarterfinal, unfortunately lost to a strong French team, and then continued to qualify for the 2018 world championships and then 2020 Tokyo. And I think just in terms of the legacy, I think it's that we need our players playing beyond college. And I think we have a number of them doing that now. And that's just the norm. That's become, I think a lot of our younger athletes now see the Natalie Achonwas, the Miranda AMs, the Kia nurses who have gone on and played professionally and now play in the best leagues in the world, you know, playing in the WNBA, and those that we have playing in Europe are playing in EuroLeague and EuroCup. And so the level of talent, the talent and the depth of talent that we have now are just night and day between, you know, what it was back in 2001 when I first began, and now 2021. So it's remarkable how far the game has come and how much it's grown in this country.
Sure. Yeah. And it's just shows, and I think you explained it brilliantly, the progress that you guys have made as a country, as a nation, to keep evolving. And I think it's well, definitely interesting that you mentioned that it's you only talked about the players, let's say. You only talked about you know, where you were at the moment and the opportunities the players had back in the day and what they have now. So that's also that also shows how committed you are and in developing the players, because without them there is nothing. And but I was diving in a little bit more into what is the preparation of the national team and then the FIBA windows. What does it look like, or it would look like, before going to a FIBA window for you as a coach? If for anyone that hasn't seen you on the courts, what's to expect?
Yeah. Well, yeah, as we mentioned, I mean, before the FIBA windows took place, a lot of our competitions in Canada, you know, we compete in FIBA Americas, or which is now AmeriCup, is our main competition. And that would typically take place in the summer. So we would get together, you know, in May, we'd maybe play in Europe, play a few competitions and tournaments, come back and play in AmeriCup. Or world championships, which might have been, you know, the end of the summer, early September, and there was really no conflict with any other leagues. And so by that, I mean for our players, but also for our coaches. And so it would be a great setup. You know, we'd be able to get together, we'd have these different phases of training camps and compete together. And, you know, at that point in time, maybe we had one or two WNBA athletes who might join us late. So then the FIBA windows came in a couple of years ago, and with competitions in November and February. So our qualification process to get to Tokyo involved a November window. And it was really interesting because, you know, you have essentially, I think, 5 days of training before you compete. And because our players are now all over the world, they had to cross, you know, several time zones. Like, we happened to be fortunate enough to be hosting that first pre-Olympic qualifier in Edmonton in November. And so the majority of our athletes were actually coming from Europe. And then we had Bridget and I think Kia at the time coming in from Australia. So you can imagine, you know, the amount of travel that they're enduring. They're essentially playing a game, then jumping on a plane, flying back to Canada, crossing numerous time zones, and then stepping on a court the next day and practicing to compete, to get ready for, you know, this major competition. So for us as coaches, you know, we were also, you know, I coach at the university level in Canada. And so we were playing games right up until the day before I left to go to Edmonton, but we were meeting, you know, in advance for sure, planning out, you know, what we were going to cover and our points of emphasis, because we had been together just in September at the AmeriCup. So we all got together, and again, 5 days. So, you know, what do you focus on to get ready for this major competition? And thankfully, we had been able to use a lot of video from our September competition. So we had been sending things out. We had been meeting with our players virtually leading into the November window. And, you know, got to compete. We played our however many games it was. It might have been 4 or 5 games, I think, at that time. And then again, everyone goes back to their pro teams. We go back to our domestic, our university teams as coaches. And then what proceeded there was, again, a number of virtual meetings leading into the February window in Belgium, where we again got together and just a few short days to prepare. And then, you know, and then we went on and we beat Sweden, Belgium, and Japan in Belgium, and went undefeated in our Olympic qualifier to get ready for Tokyo 2020. And then, of course, you know, less than a month later, everything shut down due to the pandemic. So it is super intense, you know, players having to switch gears from their pro teams and, you know, the style of play that they're using with their pro teams to then switch over to our Canadian style of play at the time. And again, like a lot of the things that we were doing, I'm sure were different than what they were doing with their pro teams. At that time, we were really trying to implement the tagging up system of defensive transition. And you can imagine that was definitely the hardest thing from a technical standpoint. Very different, especially for the perimeter players, right? The guards who are used to being safeties and running back to that now completely opposite thinking of moving forward on the shot. And so that was probably the biggest learning curve. But it was something that we decided back in November, hey, if we're going to do this in preparation for Tokyo, we got to go in now and go all in. And, you know, it certainly wasn't, it was far from perfect in November and February. But we were really happy that we made that transition to that, sure, that type of transition, defensive transition. And, you know, I think it was pretty effective in Tokyo. It wasn't amazing by any means. We certainly didn't have the amount of time together that we would have required as a team, but, with the hand that we were dealt, I thought we did a pretty good job of implementing that.
For sure. I mean, so many great things there. The first one that just remind me, I mean, that game against Belgium was really incredible. I mean, Belgium, oh, a great team, and it was a hell of a game. I think I just remember vividly like how it was. And I mean, congrats for going undefeated there as well. Well, there's different things here. So I'll go back. Yeah. We'll go back to the culture part. So, yes, because as you mentioned, in November you've just finished your games, university and the pro level. You get together, and even though you have, you know, video to share prior to that, what is the focus? Is it going on the court and doing X and O's, or is it first getting together, work, you know, having the mindset that we are here to work for each other? What's the, for sure it's a balance, but how do you find that balance?
Yeah, for us, again, a big push for our national program in the last number of years has been like a commitment of getting the players to commit and come back year after year and to spend time together. And so a lot of our culture components, I think, were pretty ingrained. We knew that 2019 was kind of like the last year going into this quad. And so a lot of the work had been done already in 2017, 18, and 19. So for us, it was more of like just a touch up, you know, like our style of play, our identity was determined. We kind of had three words that we lived by and hung our hat on. And those were dynamic, relentless, and together. And those kind of grew and kind of morphed over the years as far as like what that meant. It started out with it being kind of a reflection or an identity around our style of play. But what it became was like our entire identity in terms of how we operated, how we lived, and, you know, just how we ran everything. And so when the pandemic hit, we actually leaned heavily into the identity piece around being dynamic. You know, I think when you think of the word dynamic, you think a lot of around when you associate it with sport, I think you think of, you know, athleticism and speed and quickness, but really it's also about adapting, right? And being dynamic in the moment. And so when the pandemic hit and we weren't able to train and be in person, that was the one that we really emphasized, was around how can we be dynamic here? How can we continue to grow as a team and improve as a team, despite the fact that we can't be together face-to-face training and knowing that other teams were able to do that. So I guess the roundabout way of answering your question would be, we hope that a lot of those culture pieces were already instilled. We had a group of athletes that had been selected that knew they were going to be part of these windows. And so there were 16 of them, and we included them in both the November and February window. So even though we had 12 players that were selected and would be dressing for the games, we included all 16. So all 16 came to Edmonton, and all 16 came to Belgium. And that was just an intentional decision that we made to make sure that we had all of those people included and part of the process. So yeah, you know, like our practices and our meetings and everything continue to reinforce, I think, those identity pieces and the parts that were important to us as a team and as a unit moving forward. So then when we were on court, yeah, you know, there is a technical focus, but certainly the culture pieces were embedded within, you know, what we were working on.
Sure. And then one question there, and this, you can take it from a national team point of view or university coaching role, but how do you draw, I mean, not draw the line, but so with high standards, I mean, there is a coach that goes along, you know, high standards don't mean anything if you don't put them into action, right? So how, from a coaching perspective and the leadership point of view, how do you install them and make sure you live by those standards? Is there any takes there?
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the biggest things I've learned over the years has been whatever it is, I mean, a couple of things. One is you can't do everything really, really well, right? Like, and I think that was a common error. That was an error of mine early in my coaching career. I wanted to be able to do everything great on the court. So I was talking about this one day, high, low passing, and I was talking about low post play another day. And I was talking about using ball screens this day. And I was talking about gets the other day. So emphasizing a ton of things, you never emphasize anything. Yeah. So whatever it is that you want to hone in on and emphasize, that is what you must track in practice. It's what you must review and praise outside of practice or in practice, and continue to reinforce. Like whatever it is you emphasize is what you are telling your players is important, and that's what they're going to pick up on. And so for me, I think it was a matter of honing in on those few items. Like you can't win all the battles. You can't focus on 50 things. You really have to narrow in on a few and be great at those few.
Good. Okay. Yeah, that's super interesting. It's like we say with picking your poison on defense, you also have to do it on the court and from a coaching perspective, pick the things that you want the most or you need the most for your program. And now, well, moving a little bit, because actually I have a player asking this question when I told him I would interview you. So what is now, maybe talking a little bit more about the university role.
Sure.
You don't have the the pool of talent of the Canadian players like you do with the national team. And so
right.
how is the recruitment perspective, and how much is it basketball specific things, you know, how tall they are, how much they jump, how much they play on ball, and so on offense and on defense. Now, how much is it a mindset? And if so, if it's a big weight, how do you try to measure?
Oh, that is such a great question. It's interesting. You know, I coach at a university that's in the middle of our country. We're in not a very densely populated area. No one would consider Saskatchewan the basketball hotbed of Canada by any means. You know, that would be Toronto and Ontario. So we are, you know, we, like I said, we're on the prairies. We live amongst a bunch of farmers and we're in a city of 250,000 people. Our province is only, you know, a million. So our population density is pretty small. But the type of players, the type of athletes that are produced from this province, it's amazing the number, from a global perspective, the number of professional athletes that come out of this province. And most of them are hockey players, but there have been a number, considering our population, the number of like national team basketball players that have come from here are like, it's disproportionate. And so you try to figure out like, why is that? And it's exactly because of what you said, it's the mindset. So because we're, you know, a farming type community, hard work is like instilled in these people from day one. It's just like part of the culture, part of the fabric of the people that live here. And so, you know, early on when I started off here, we were not very good at all, but the players that we got, they weren't talented basketball players, but they had tremendous work ethic. They were very coachable. and they had toughness to them, you know, they both physical and mental toughness. And it's something that I tell the players that we're recruiting, in that it doesn't matter how talented you are, you know, when you're coming out of high school, ready to go into college, because the jump is just so great. You know, so you're at a certain level, but in order for you to do well at the university level, there's a massive gap that you need to make up. And, you know, the only way you're going to do that is through hard work, being coachable, and being tough. And so if you lack any of those components, it really doesn't matter how talented you are at that time, you will just stay at the same level. And that's what we found. You know, we got a lot of these athletes who weren't recruited by other universities, but they had these intangibles, you know, that they brought to the table. And it was fun to watch, because over the course of their 5 years here, you know, in their first year, you know, they play against players who are much more talented. They play against teams that had a lot more talent and highly recruited players. But by the end of their careers, they were beating those same teams and better players than some of those ones that were recruited out of high school. And it was because of those mindset pieces and those things that were just kind of innately in them. And so, you know, fast forward 20 years later, and that continues to be the, I would say the big part of the culture of our team here, is just the type of player that it attracts. We constantly say it is not an easy place to come and play here. It is, you know, we have very high standards. There are expectations because of the success of the program. And, you know, I think for some people that attracts them, they love that. They want to work hard. They want to embrace the challenge and the grind. And for others, it's not so attractive. You know, it might be a little too hard for them, or maybe they don't want to be in the limelight and have those expectations on them. And so it's been a really interesting look at things, but that really has been the mainstay. You know, our best players and our best teams have had this core of athletes who have those intangibles and those pieces to their personality that you, I think you have it or you don't. You know, it's been instilled in you at a young age, or it's not. And it's really hard to change it. You can develop it, but unless you have a certain component of it, it's really hard at this age to then create it.
Well, and then just, so if we look at recruiting international players, because as we talked before starting, I mean, you have a Portuguese player that actually made this get in contact. And
yes.
So, well, it's not the case that a European player can go there and come back just to see how it is and how high standards you have. So is it a case of you telling the players that you're trying to recruit or just interested in going there that, you know, high standards are here, and then see if they are willing to do it? Or is there any type of strategy that whenever you are talking to them, you try to assess if they will do, you know, the hard work?
Yeah, definitely through conversation and then just learning more about them as people, I think it starts to shine through. Just talking about different scenarios, whether it was on the basketball court and talking about, you know, for local players, I think it's easier to see, but, you know, what's more important? I think on the women's side, this is something that I find very interesting too, is it more important for you to win, or is it more important for you to play? Like what is a higher value item for you? And on the women's side, I'd say it is harder and harder to find those players that say winning is most important. Like being on a winning team is my most important value item. Many of them want to just play. Go somewhere where they're good enough that they're going to play, and winning, great if it happens, but aren't totally driven to do what it takes to be the best. Okay. And
yeah,
and I think, again, I keep saying on the women's side, because I think it is a bit of a unique thing for girls and young women to be that competitive, because it's not the norm. And if you are that competitive, I think you sometimes feel a bit different from your peers, especially if you're in if your peer group doesn't include a lot of athletes. So to have that drive, you know, when you're that competitive, sometimes you're not the nice girl, right? And so it can be, it's a difficult balance, I think, for them. So that sometimes is the differentiating question that I sometimes ask to see what they say.
Definitely interesting that you mentioned that specific to the female, you know, sport and basketball. I think it's, but you touched there on something I find interesting. You know, you can either, or let's say polarizing here a little bit, you can either try to play as much as possible and be comfortable. I would characterize that as being more comfortable. But at the same time, if you do choose to go to a winning team, it's probably because if you want to play, which is still valid, right? Everyone wants to play, but you to fight through that and try to become as best as you can be. So it's a great point. I mean, I'm sure that the player that asked me the question will enjoy it.
I think it's also a, it also measures a bit of self-confidence when you ask that. You know, when you outline to players that it's difficult, when you say that, you know, you're not going to step in and play right away, you get to see who are the players that are confident in their abilities to come and work and become better so that they can play. You know, you want those ones that have that drive. And again, it comes from self-confidence, for sure. Being prepared and putting in the work. Yeah.
And then moving on now to more basketball specific topics. And I go to your background. So you were a big player when you played. And so I would love to know your perspective on how much the game has changed. And I mean, which is a lot, right? And
yes,
I mean, is it changing for the best? And how, what perspective do you give to a player now, or even to coaches to try to develop big players mm-hmm. in the current day and age?
It's really cool, you know, like back when I was, when I played in university, I mean, you're playing with the narrow key. The three-point line still has been moved back since then. So the key has changed. The three-point line has changed. Even watching game film from back in, you know, 20, 30 years ago, there were two post players that played right down on the block. And, you know, a lot of teams are playing three out, two in, a lot of mid-range jump shots. It's phenomenal. And so now with the post play, you know, then it kind of evolved to four out, one in, and maybe there'd be one kind of permanent post who would be in there. And now, even if you are playing four out, one in, the one in is really out a lot of the time and really dynamic, getting in and out or posting up different players. And now it's, you know, moved to more of the five out. So, I do think there is still a place for a dominant kind of low post presence. I think, especially at our level, having one, you know, we've always emphasized that we really worked hard at developing our bigs, having great footwork, but also being very dynamic, getting them out on the perimeter as well, clearing the lane, being great screeners and passers. So, you know, I love watching, you know, Jokic. I think he's just like the preeminent post player. If you're trying to develop someone, like, watch his game, man. Holy, he's impressive. Just his ability to pass and see the floor, shoot the ball, help create, like, just the two-man game is so fun to watch with him and Murray. So, yeah, so as far as like developing a post player, I think it's great for the game because, you know, like at the youth level, hopefully coaches will see that everyone needs to have all skills. You know, you need to multi-skill your athletes. And I think for so long, you know, again, I think in Canada, we're culprits of doing this. The developmental age is you put the tallest kid closest to the basket, you put the shortest kid with the ball and tell them they're the point guard, and everyone else kind of fills in around them. And, you know, as they grow and develop, then all of a sudden that post player stops growing and they're 5'10". And, you know, maybe the smallest kid at that point grows and they're taller. So I think just being, you know, again, very, sounds very cliche, but positionless, but very skillful, and spending time working on a variety of skills for all players. And so giving them each an opportunity to play different spots on the floor, I think is key. I think, you know, basketball concepts are basketball concepts and everyone needs to know them from different positions. Yeah, as I said, I still think there's a place for a dominant low post. Whether they can shoot the three or not, I still think there's a place for them. But certainly the more multifaceted you are as a basketball player, regardless of height or size or position, I think the more valuable that you are to your team.
Yeah, and then well, moving from there, because definitely the usage of low post players and fitting the ball inside has decreased so much. But so and then you, as you mentioned, it's much more dynamic now. So the bigs that are inside still go outside to play pick and roll, to play get actions. And so do you have a preference there between, because if we do only play pick and roll, for sure it's still to look for the bigs, but they won't have the ball so much in their hands. So as a philosophy, would you say that playing get actions helps them to get some touches as well? And then is it applicable to your level at all, college level?
For gets?
Yeah, for get action. So having
the love get action. Okay. Love get action. We started using it with national team a number of years ago, and it was kind of something that a lot of other teams weren't doing, and it was highly effective. We used it here at the university level. Again, we had a player from Latvia come over. She was actually a professional player and came here and played 5 years and won 2 national championships with us. And she had the quickest trigger, like could get her shot off and deep. But yes, she wasn't a great pick and roll player. You know, she didn't want to create off the dribble. She wanted it back into her hands without the dribble and make an easy read. And so I think gets are easier to make reads. I think they're more dangerous. And I think they open up more options for the big too, you know, especially if they can handle a little bit. They're just a bit more dynamic. I find in pick and roll, it's almost the 3 players not involved are, you know, depending on what you're doing off ball, they can be a little bit static, you know, if they're just spotting up, where in gets, you can involve a little bit more action happening off ball to create some advantages. But that would be my preference for sure. But I think, you know, there's so much emphasis on the pick and roll game around the world. You do have to have it in your system for the simple reason that you need to be able to defend it. Even if you don't run it offensively, you have to be able to defend it, because still, if you can get a 2-man game going with some very skillful players, it alone can be, you know, it can be daggers for the defense.
Yeah, and even so, I mean, at some extent, the get action and the pick and roll look very, you know, similar, and it's at some degree they are very similar. But and just flipping that now, so going to the preseason, you got your players back either from previous years or new ones, and you start to work on pick and roll. How do you structure? Is it let's get back or let's get really good at playing against the switch, or is it let's show them some coverages and then get better also seeing what the other teams will do?
Yeah. We usually narrow it down to 2 different defensive schemes, the ones that we would most commonly see at our level, and then spend time getting good at attacking both of those. And then a little bit later, we'll add in some different things for sure. And same thing with the gets, like, okay, give them 2 different schemes defensively when we're drilling it. Okay, defense, you can do one or the other, and then start incorporating a few more options for them to make reads. So, and we find that works. You know, you're always going to get the odd thing that, you know, one team does this against a ball screen that's different from anyone else. But you can usually cover that off in the week leading into playing against them. So if you get the majority of your reps against the majority of what you're going to see, I think that helps. But yeah, that would definitely be how we start things off.
And then from that perspective, I guess, I mean, so if you're talking about you know, at the same time that you are drilling your offense, you're also practicing your defense. It means at least from those 2 coverages that you do defensively to prepare offense, one of them will have to be your main defensive coverage, right? Does that make sense?
Yes, for sure.
Okay.
Yep.
All right. Well, yep. That's great to know. And by the way, I'm curious, because just going back to the beginning of the conversation, you mentioned the tagging up that you played as a transition defense philosophy with the national team. So first of all, do you also do it with the university team?
We do now. Okay. Yeah.
Try.
Yeah. We played around with a bit of a hybrid of it in 2019, 2020. But because we, and I didn't bring it in right at the start of the season, and that's always so hard to try to change something partway through the season. You know, we tried to spend some time over the Christmas break, but by then it's just, it's late. It's too hard to make that change. And we have a point guard who's pretty small, and she, you know, she is so inclined to get back, and we were okay with that. So what we tried to do with our university team that year was kind of 4 out of 5 tagging up. But you know, it was okay. But now this year, yeah, right from the start, we're working on tagging up, and we've been happy with it. Like, it's not perfect by any means, but the simplicity of it, once you get over the hesitation around, oh my gosh, like, what do you do here? What if a guard attacks and they're out of the play and we're matching up and we get beat over the top? Like, there's so many what ifs that you can create in your mind, but honestly, the players can just figure it out. You know, if you have ball pressure on the ball immediately, you can usually sort through any issues that may have been created by, you know, rotations or again, a small that gets out of the play because of an attack at the rim. And that's what I found is the one that's the hardest to neutralize, is if you've got a point guard who attacks, they finish out of bounds, the ball gets, you know, inbounded quickly, and they're behind the play.
And then just on that. So, I mean, what is the hardest thing or for any coaches starting now or thinking about starting to applying, let's say, for the next season? Where do you start from? Is it from just the habit point of view of not run back, actually go to offensive rebound? Or is it something more technical with where you go, how to do it, how to play out of some disadvantage that might happen?
Yeah, I think the very first one is just developing that habit, breaking the old habit of moving backwards to moving forwards. And so that was our thing. That was the very first thing that we tried to emphasize, and we tracked it and we got video and we'd watch prior to practice the next day, was just, okay, boom, at the moment of the shot, who's moving forward, who's not doing anything, or who's moving backwards. And so once you get that, and then you can start getting more technical around, okay, the angle at which you are moving towards the basket. So again, the corners are the most dangerous places. Getting out of those corners at the appropriate time at the appropriate angle. And then the bigs, same thing. So the other really hard situation is when you have a talented offensive rebounder that is used to getting past the defender and just getting the ball. That's the other hard one I found, is that, what do you do? Do you give them free rein to go get the basket, go get the ball? Or do you say, no, you have to find someone and push them under? And I listened to a few coaches who've used this before, and all of them have said, you have to tell them, you have to go to the player. You cannot just run past that person to go get the ball. So again, the initial hesitation is, well, we're not going to be, you know, as good on the offensive glass. We're not going to come down with as many offensive rebounds, when in fact that's counter to what ends up happening. You actually, if all five people commit to the system, you end up getting more offensive rebounds and in a position where you can take advantage of them as well. So it's pretty neat to kind of see those numbers come to fruition, like to kind of see the hesitation, but then later on, as you get better, okay, how it kind of results in, you know, more possessions, higher percentage shots, more awards.
I think for the coaches listening, it's great. I mean, I tell from my perspective, we've heard so much about coaches talking about it and the system and so on, but now it's not just about it, but also the reflection, because you are reflecting on what you've done. So there is, for sure, there is some try and error, and nothing will be ever perfect, but great thoughts there. And then moving to the end of the episode, I just want to thank you before finishing off, but thanks a lot for your time. It's really a pleasure to meet
my
you.
My pleasure, entirely.
And then, so I would like to ask you this. How is it from a life balance point of view? Because I assume it's been a crazy career since you started coaching, and for the past many years doing both national team and university at the same time. So I assume it's hectic at some point. So How does that work out for you? And yeah. So just any reflection from that point of view?
You know, I think to me, it became the norm. You know, I started coaching when I was 26 at the university level. And that very first summer, I coached our provincial team. So, you know, we practiced all through the summer. And so it was like I had two jobs right from the very beginning. And I coached provincial team a couple of years. And then, bang, I got my opportunity with the national team only like 3 years into my career. And so I just got used to every summer. That's just what I do. You know, every off season is you get to go and work with national team. And the other thing was that I got to go in and spend time with some great friends, some great people. So the coaches that I got to work with, the athletes that I was able to work with, they became great friends of mine. And so the balance piece, I think, you know, I think if you're coaching and you're used to coaching just a certain part of the year for say 10 years of your career, and then boom, you do two jobs or coach two different teams, I think that balance would be something that, it would be a hard adjustment. But for me, because I've just, that's been my norm. My ability to balance was just, okay, this is just kind of what you do. And like I said, because I was with some very close friends and some really great people all along the way, it became pretty easy to balance both. But, you know, after 20 years, you start to think, oh man, like, yeah, I really haven't had a holiday. You know, you get kind of days here and there and, you know, a week here and there, but there's no sustained time away from the game. But that's also kind of what you sign up for, right? Like when you're a coach, do you ever stop thinking about the game, stop thinking about how you can improve your team or what you can do better? I'm not too sure. So even if you have holidays, I think your brain is still working on those kinds of thoughts.
And what but, about and then I mean that's a great point, and I think you mentioned and it's funny enough because when I did the podcast with Kirby from Canada too,
yes,
you know, talking about that personal side that's so important, that environment is key for the coaches and players and everyone involved. And then just I have to ask it, do you still feel pressure? Because after so many years with national team playing finals and you know, do or die games and championships also with the university team, did it change your perspective? I mean, I don't know, looking back, because
I'm sure it did. I'm sure it has. You know, I think with the national team early on, and same thing with my university team, it's almost like they've had parallel experiences. My university team was terrible before I got here. So there were low expectations. I think with national team and with both these teams, as time went on, expectations increased exponentially, right? To the point where with national team, now we're talking about meddling on the international stage at a major competition at Worlds or at Olympic Games. It became where just qualifying for now Olympics and for World Championships is almost just a foregone conclusion. You know, that's the expectation. That's a minimum expectation, is to get there. And same thing with our university team. Now it's, you know, anything less than a Canada West, like a conference championship, would be seen as a disappointment. Anything less than a medal at nationals would be seen as a disappointment. So I think there's for sure more pressure, more expectation, but not externally. I think it's always internal, right? Like, you never want to see your program start to dip. You always want something better for them. You always want to improve. You always want to be better because, you know, you've got the target on your back all the time. And so it's continuing to try to stay ahead of the curve. But it's,
it,
yeah.
Sorry, and is it, so you're saying you still feel pressure, but in a sustainable or positive, because that's the positive way, because that makes you strive for more, right? Is that your point, right?
Yeah, you know, I think you kind of have to be a little bit, you know, there's a little bit of paranoia. I think I always think my team is terrible, right? Like, and part of that stems from working with national team, and then you come back to your university team and you're like, oh my gosh, how are we ever going to score? We're short and we're slow and we can't shoot. And then, you know, you kind of go along and okay, we're actually okay. We're winning some games here. And I just think for both, it's the important piece is always just on development, right? Getting better each day. We never talk about winning. We never talk about championships. It's always just, you know, how can you individually be better today? We always talk about, you know, specific skills and give them little goals to work on, to again, focus on one or two things instead of 25 things that they can't do right now. So that's the individual perspective. And then as a team, how can we continue to get better? And then as coaches, how are we continuing to develop and grow and improve as we kind of go along? So it seems to be a formula that's worked well, and hopefully it continues to do so.
Yeah, great to hear. And then because I love to travel, and I've been fortunate to do a little bit, and I'm sure you did, you've been done doing the same. What is there something you've taken from abroad into you that you've taken like as yours right now, and you can take this from a basketball perspective or anything life.
Oh gosh, yeah. I mean, I've been so fortunate to be able to travel the world, see so many places. I think again, early in my career, being able to see some of the great teams in Europe play and what they did, some conceptual ideas. That to me was kind of like my secret little advantage, you know, before the days of being able to pull up any game on YouTube and watch it on our computer, you know, being over in Europe and seeing the Spanish teams play, seeing the French teams play. I think, you know, I remember early on watching Spain and just their post movement, watching them cut under the basket when they were being dribbled at. That was like mind-blowing to me. I'd never thought of doing that before. And so that was something that I took and continue to use to this day. And, but yeah, I mean, I love Europe. I love, love watching European teams play. And I feel like I try to take something from every team that we play against. You know, what is it that they do really well that we can incorporate, or, you know, some small little snippet of thing, whether it's like movement on penetration like that, the Spanish thing, whether it's, you know, off ball actions or sets or things like that. I think there's just so much to learn. There's so many great ideas out there and amazing coaches out there.
Sure. Well, that's great to hear. Lisa, thank you. Thank you so much. I hope you have a great season ahead.
Thank you very much.
Great season. And thank you so much for your time. It was great.
I'm thank sure you.
All the coaches will love.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much for the invitation. All the best to you in your season as well. And hopefully we chat again soon.